Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Let me just take a moment to thank all of you who have been listening to us and subscribing to the podcast, and suggest that if you haven't already done so, you ought to consider subscribing to one of our Bulwark newsletters. We put out three a day. I put out morning shots in the morning. JVL has a midday newsletter, and Jim Swift wraps up the day with overtime. So we really appreciate that. If you look at today's morning shots, I talk about the pandemic of madness that in the midst of this coronavirus, America has an outbreak of crazy. And I want to just talk about that in a moment. Just to, you know, take the moment that we're in right now, when we are opening up the country. You have the governors who are ignoring even Trump's own guidelines. You can tell that people are kind of sick at are sick and tired of staying at home, and there's kind of a jailbreak going on. So it almost sense that the mood is that people think that this is over, it's done, we're moving on. And this is happening at the exact moment we're getting word that the pandemic is spreading and it's growing. I mean, it's just, you look at this as you know, Trump is, you know, shifting into the rah-rah mode, where we're seeing these draft models suggesting, you know, a steady rise in the infections and the deaths over the next several weeks, reaching about 3,000 a day by June, which would be double the current rate. So, and it also, we have these protests that have broken out around the country, some of these demonstrations. And I link to some of the pictures of the demonstrations in Massachusetts and in Arizona, where people are going, it's a hoax, it's a hoax, it's a hoax, it's not pandemic, and pushing back against masks. And you turn on Fox News and it's just a drumbeat about you shouldn't have to wear a mask, you shouldn't have to engage in social distancing. And that's why it's the pandemic of madness, because you want to raise your hand and say, excuse me, do you understand that we are at this moment where we're being told that the number of people dying is going to be exponentially greater than what we were told last week? So, okay, to break through all of this is one of our regular guests on the Bulwark Podcast and a contributor to the Bulwark, Kim Whaley, professor of law, legal expert, CBS News contributor, and author of the book, How to Read the Constitution and Why. So good to have you back, Kim.
Happy to be here. Good morning, Charlie.
So can we start with morning in America?
Yeah.
I just want to walk. There are moments when I'm just going to admit, I'm just going to fess up that I want to wallow in this moment. So, and this is a big week for Abraham Lincoln. Did you know that, you know, people are beginning to appreciate Lincoln more and more? A lot of people don't know that. There seems to be a certain irony that the president goes to the Lincoln Memorial and says that he was treated worse than Lincoln. And then this group called the Lincoln Project, and you're familiar with Lincoln Project, and I'm guessing many of our listeners are. This is a group put together by, they are never Trumpers, the completely irrelevant never Trumpers, the completely pointless, dead in the water, dead as a doornail, never Trumpers, George Conway, Rick Wilson, a lot of folks that I think you'd be familiar with. Well, they've been putting out a series of ads, and their best to date, I think, is called Morning in America. The play on the words, of course, theirs is Morning with a U, Morning in America, as opposed to the 1980s Ronald Reagan Morning in America. So it's a playoff of this. It's a brilliantly done ad. And let's just play. It runs for about a minute. Unfortunately, you don't get the visuals, but I want to make sure you hear this, because Donald Trump watched this last night on Fox, and it apparently ruined his whole night. Let's play it.
There's morning in America. Today, more than 60,000 Americans have died from a deadly virus Donald Trump ignored. With the economy in shambles, more than 26 million Americans are out of work. The worst economy in decades. Trump bailed out Wall Street, but not Main Street. This afternoon, millions of Americans will apply for unemployment. And with their savings run out, many are giving up hope. Millions worry that a loved one won't survive COVID-19. There's mourning in America. And under the leadership of Donald Trump, our country is weaker and sicker and poorer. And now, Americans are asking, if we have another 4 years like this, will there even be an America?
Paid for by the Lincoln Project, which is responsible for the content of this advertising.
So Politico, in something of an understatement, says the ad apparently infuriated the president. I mean, Kim, that I got to say, that is a great ad. And isn't it ironic that it is the completely irrelevant Never Trumpers who are putting out stuff like this? I'm guessing that there are Democrats going, why are we not doing this?
I kind of wish we could rebrand that Never Trumper label and call them common sensors or something like that. And that is not S-E-N-S-O-R-S, but having common sense, weak or sick or poor, this is not up to debate anymore. And finally, someone is telling it like it is. And the fact that it's not coming from the crazy progressive left label is probably just underscores the new brand, the common sense brand.
And it really got under, got under Trump's skin. And I think because of the folks, you know, Morning America is the play on the 1984 campaign commercial and Reagan's slogan, which I think is going to be the theme of the Trump campaign, right? Is that it's where America is coming back. It's morning in America again. And so this is a shot at so many of the things that Trump thinks are his own brand. It speaks to his failure to deliver for his populist base to turn the country around. So in the middle of the night last night, he's tweeting out a group of rhino Republicans. Okay, this is the president of the United States, goes on a tweet storm. A group of rhino Republicans who failed badly 12 years ago, then again 8 years ago, then got badly beaten by me, a political first timer, 4 years ago, have copied, no imagination, the concept of an ad from Ronald Reagan, Morning in America, doing everything possible to get even for all of their many failures. And he goes on and he attacks George Conway, who calls him moon faces. I don't know what Kellyanne did to her deranged loser of a husband, moon face, but it must have been really bad, Trump wrote of George Conway. So, Kim, I don't know if you know George, but I'm guessing that George will be so offended by this, he might not be able to leave the house. He'll be so upset.
I'm sure George probably will weigh in on Twitter as well. But didn't we also have an attack on another George this week from our president, George W. Bush, who thoughtfully issued another ad, for lack of a better word, that basically said, let's come together. And these are my words, as we, the people, we, the Americans, have each other's backs. Let's have a moment like George Bush did post 9/11, where we lost a fraction of Americans that we've lost so far in just a few short weeks. And our current president felt the need to attack President Bush as well.
Yeah, it's there. That does seem to be that. Now, that is the Trump brand. But I think what's also interesting about this, though, is you want to talk about an own goal, because as a result of Trump going after all of these guys, going after this ad, exponentially more people will see them. And what a gift he just gave to George Conway and Rick Wilson and John Weaver and Steve Schmidt and Reed Galen and all the people behind this. He couldn't have, you know, 10 million people may watch this as a result of Trump's tantrum. And so he gave them a gift beyond anything that they could have done for themselves. And that's what's that, for all of the talk about Trump's, you know, innate genius or his instincts, this has got to be one of the strangest moves that it's so easy to get under his skin and to lash out. And now he has elevated this group. I can't even imagine what their fundraising is going to be. I can't imagine what the impact of this is going to be nationally for what had been a relatively modest internet ad, very, very well produced. But Trump himself has made this a BFD.
Yeah. And you know, people have said for a long time he's his own worst enemy, but he seems to outmaneuver that slogan. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I've been waiting for when it actually manifests in a way that makes sense. And maybe this is that moment where he's the petulant child that can't stand any criticism and doesn't have grown-ups around him to tell him to stop throwing the spaghetti all over the wall. And so he did it again. But we'll just have to see whether people pay attention in this moment of complete chaos and meltdown.
Meltdown and death. And you want to talk about a juxtaposition where, you know, the Trump is cheering on the governors as they ignore the White House guidelines and the race to reopen. There are the new models which would suggest many more Americans will die, and in part they're going to be dying because there is this rush to reopen the country. And it's interesting, just listening to, I don't know if you saw Chris Christie. Chris Christie is out there doing an interview, and he's saying, yeah, people are just going to have to accept it. They're going to have to suck it up. People are going to die. That's what we kind of have to do. I'm being slightly unfair to him, although not very. And this is going to be, Kim, this is going to be the Trump line, right? Is that, hey, it's a trade-off. You want to be able to go to Arby's? We're going to have to do this. We're going to have to have perhaps 100,000, 200,000 deaths. No matter how many deaths there are, we will declare victory. We'll blame somebody else, and we'll try to convince you that it was worth it.
Like, yeah, I think Chris Christie's, the criticism of him is a bit unfounded in that he just kind of called it like it is, and that is, we're in a moment with this pandemic, mass death, suffering, PTSD, poverty, hunger, lost jobs, crashing economy. I mean, you name it. And he's essentially saying you're on your own. You know, it's going to be a person by person response because the states that are reopening in part, I mean, I'm sure you saw it in your newsletter, Oklahoma, for example, had to withdraw, Stillwater had to withdraw its face covering order because of now there's a counterbalance concern that there's going to be violence in response to enforcing logical orders to save lives. And so we are collectively running into ongoing traffic right now. And some of us are going to stay on the sidewalk or pull our kid onto the sidewalk and the rest will just go leaping to their fate in this moment. And the federal government is just along for the ride and for self-preservation. And the question will be really, is there going to be any accountability in November if we even have an election? I mean, it's just dumbfounding.
I want to get to that. By the way, thank you for bringing up that Stillwater, Oklahoma story, because that one really haunted me. You know, this is a place where they had a mask order. If you're going to go into an establishment, you had to wear the mask. They had to pull it back within like 24 hours after threats of violence. And the city manager actually posted this, and I have an excerpt in my newsletter. It's like, in the short time beginning on May 1st, that face coverings have been required for entry into stores and restaurants, store employees have been threatened with physical violence and showered with verbal abuse. In addition, there has been one threat of violence using a firearm. We know somebody was killed in Michigan. Right. Many of those objections cite the mistaken belief that the requirement is unconstitutional, and under their theory, one cannot be forced to wear a mask. No court or law supports this view, and it goes on. But it's like, really? This is the way people are reacting right now. We've made the mask this symbol of social of political and tribal identity.
Well, I'm so glad you raised the constitutional issue. As you know, you mentioned my book, and we've had many conversations about constitutional illiteracy in this country. And I get asked this question regularly through this process: is it okay? Is it legal for states to do this? And I just want to reiterate again, it is legal. There, it is not unconstitutional for the government to impose safety measures to protect the broader public. This is why we buckle our seatbelts. This is why there's a law requiring vaccinations to go to public school. There's all kinds of things that we as a society buy into every single day to protect the public. And the notion that I have a right, if I'm infected with coronavirus, to spread it around and infect and potentially kill other people defies basic rule of law that precedes the United States of America itself, goes back to common law England. There are logical, rational rules put in place so that we can all live in a measured, fair, safe society. And wearing a mask is not a hard one. And we seem to still be stuck in this question: is it constitutional for states to do this? And I just cannot pound the table enough. Yes, it is constitutional, unless it was implemented in a way that was unfair to protected populations like African Americans, people of color, women. You know, there are certain categories that the government cannot indiscriminately discriminate against. But certainly when it comes to protecting the public health, there's a case going back to 1905 involving a criminal prosecution for a man who refused to get a mandatory vaccination. And the Supreme Court of the United States says, you know what? Too bad. Massachusetts can impose that on you. And face masks are not far from that. And we're just, it just, as a law professor, it just makes me a little bit cuckoo to continue to have to make this argument. But of course, people are getting their guns up to protect their right to not wear masks.
So I wish I'd been able to locate this. I saw it on Twitter, where, of course, all great thoughts eventually go. And that's the thing about Twitter. It's, you know, it can be a cesspool 90% of the time. And then every once in a while I go, wow, that is a great point. And it was somebody saying that these protests against the mass are a little bit equivalent to imagine mass protests in London in 1940 against Churchill's blackout regulations.
Yes, yeah,
don't tread on me. I'm not keeping my blinds closed. I'm a free person. Well, yeah, we're going to enforce that. But again, that didn't happen back then, did it? Because people understood what the stakes were. You know, we're talking about we spent too much time, I think, talking about the president's tweets. I'm guilty of that, too. What he does in public. You had a great piece in The Bulwark this week, describing this transformation from within the government that I think could have longer term implications. Your piece, which I strongly urge people to go and look up, forget competence. Trump wants loyalty. The president's cronies want to hunt out anyone in government who won't kowtow to him. And then you walk through some of the agencies where, in fact, this has been happening. And this is one of my main worries about a second term, because we're already seeing how the president is using his power to transform the federal government into his own image, including the destruction of oversight, the firing of the IGs.
Yeah, these are sort of boring, nondescript, technical, wonky concepts. And I know because I teach a course to law students called administrative law. And the thing I say the first day is, listen, much of our government is by the quote unquote bureaucrats. But there are a lot of measures that have been put in place by Congress over the years to ensure the much reviled bureaucrats actually stay in their lanes. There's a lot of oversight, including, as you mentioned, inspectors general, which was a major Watergate reform. And they are quasi-independent. The point is to basically audit the various government agencies to make sure they're functioning in a way that serves the public interest and that is free of corruption. And of course, as some of us have know, and we've been watching, this president has been politicizing the inspectors general, starting with the transfer of the whistleblower complaint to Congress relating to the Ukraine affair, and the Justice Department's essentially burying of that, and a real debate as to whether that person was legitimately doing his job, which of course he was. But also, we have in the piece that I talked about that you mentioned, the Office of Personnel Management. It's essentially the Federal Human Resources Agency that deals with everything from health and retirement benefits for federal employees. We have the president appointing people that whose mission is going forward to basically rid, quote, back to our tagline, never Trumpers, to take disloyalists out of the ranks of the federal government and replace them with cronies. And this is really a problem for a legitimate, measured government going forward. And I don't think people have processed or even thought about the implications of, you know, having corrupt, incompetent people driving the bus that is the massive American economy going forward. It's quite dangerous, not only for us, but for our children. And as you mentioned, even with a new president, somebody is going to have to rebuild the corrosion from inside, basically heal all that, in addition to healing our international standing and to healing our healthcare system, immigration, on and on and on, the things that have been destroyed for decades, but in particular under this particular administration.
And Congress has a role in this as well. We found out this week, and this almost feels like just a minor parenthesis, although it's also a very, very big deal, that the administration is refusing to allow some of its key figures in fighting the pandemic to testify before the House of Representatives.
Yeah, this is another thing. I mean, government in the sunshine, transparency, the Freedom of Information Act, that also was kind of made more robust around Watergate. The idea is if we know what's going on in government, then we can hold government accountable. And I thought it was really interesting that Secretary of State Pompeo made a statement attacking China for hiding the ball when here we are with Anthony Fauci being gagged, not only publicly, but also being precluded from testifying unless the chief of staff authorized anybody in the administration to tell the United States Congress what's going on with the coronavirus response. I mean, it's just, it's mind blowing. And the justification is that we're just too busy working on this. Yeah. Of course, wow. You know, South Korea found out the same day we did of its first test, right? Or excuse me, its first confirmed case. And they've had several days of no new cases, let alone deaths. And as you mentioned at the top of the show, the estimates are that we're going to increase by 2-4% per day. We are on the upswing, and with opening the states up, it's going to just continue. So the question is, what is the Trump administration doing with the time spared with Dr. Fauci from talking to the Congress, besides sitting in front of our esteemed former president Lincoln's memorial to have essentially, you know, a propaganda speech with Fox News?
No, and I think that the failure of Congress to be more aggressive in asserting its prerogatives, this is something we've been, you know, talking about for the last 3 years. It just seems to be somewhat more dramatic at the moment that you wouldn't have the normal, just the normal oversight and the fact that the president has essentially decided that he's not going to deal with the House of Representatives anymore. I think, which is interesting, except when they pass legislation. Okay, so you mentioned something earlier in the podcast that I don't want to gloss over because we're walking the tightrope between you know wanting to warn people about a significant problem and not sounding hysterical, but I admit that I have been paranoid on the question of the election long before it was fashionable to be paranoid. The President of the United States cannot delay the election, but given the trajectory, and I use that word too much, I know that, but given what we know about this pandemic and the fact that it may resurge in the fall, how concerned should we be about the November election and whether or not it's going to be impacted?
I mean, this goes back to your point on Congress. There's so much work that Congress needs to do legislatively. And one of the things is $2 to $4 billion to the states to ensure that we have an actual legitimate election in the fall. And of course, you know, from being a Wisconsinite, the debacle that happened with their primaries, where people now, I think it's up to 40, were confirmed infected with the coronavirus by exercising their right to vote. We also spoke a lot through impeachment. And as a separation of power scholar, you know, I've come to the conclusion that the only real check on the office of the presidency that's left is the vote. And I think really why Trump's ignoring the House of Representatives, because essentially the Senate, in acquitting the president of obstructing Congress, said, you know, you can do whatever you want in obstructing Congress. There will be no accountability. So here we are going into the fall. We know also that the United States Postal Service is on the verge of bankruptcy. So most people say that experts say, and I have a book coming out on voting in June called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. Most experts say that we need to have robust mail-in voting in November to protect the public from basically, you know, getting sick by just exercising that right. But, you know, that requires a lot of infrastructure, including literally paper, certain kinds of paper that needs to be produced, machinery to ensure that the barcodes are properly accounted for each voter so that this myth of voter fraud doesn't actually come to fruition. And right now, there are really two options. One is we can just hope against hope that the election fairies come down between now and November and fix all of this. Congress can step in, which it can under the Constitution, actually impose nationwide voting systems. People don't realize that, but it is constitutional. Or the states can do it, but the states are busy and they don't have the money in this moment. Or we could hobble through the election in the fall, understand that certain people will probably get sick, a lot will be disenfranchised. And then the question will be, what will the legitimacy of that outcome be? How will the American public, regardless of who wins, how will they treat that outcome? There's a strong sense people will just think it's fake, it's legitimate, it's illegitimate, it's not serious. And then what happens to American democracy?
Yep. I think that's the key here, because I think it's becoming increasingly apparent that there's not going to be a bipartisan solution to this. The lines have been drawn. Trump world has decided that they will do absolutely nothing to make it easier to vote. They think of that as being a code for voter fraud. So we're going to have to limp through. Maybe there will be some money, but there are two big questions. Number one, will the election actually be legitimate? And number two, will it be perceived to be legitimate? And that's the point that's so important, because you know that if Donald Trump is defeated, is he going to graciously concede defeat? Is there any prospect that he is going to say, yes, I lost fair and square? And if he doesn't, if he says the election was stolen, and he's already tweeting out about that, what does that do for the future of democracy if you have 40% of the country that thinks that in some ways it is illegitimate? And by the way, let's be honest about it. It might be the other way as well, if he is reelected and under questionable circumstances. But here's my concern is that the election itself is a snafu. That the results, it takes a long time to resolve after fierce controversy, maybe even, Supreme Court decisions, and that half the country does not accept the legitimacy. And I think your question, what does that mean for the future of democracy, I think is profound, because I'm guessing that you at least I feel this way, that I've been looking at November as kind of like a finish line, that you figure that, okay, it will be resolved in November, but what if it's not resolved?
Yeah, I mean, this is back to Mueller. I mean, it's win-win-win for Vladimir Putin in terms of destroying the integrity of American democracy, doing it from within, not from without, with troops. I mean, I heard Eric Holder, former attorney general, on Bill Maher talking about this very issue. And his answer was, well, if Donald Trump doesn't step down, then we've got law enforcement that can actually make that happen. A, I'm not so sure law enforcement's going to have to decide who their leader is. And even B, if that's the solution, I mean, it's hard to imagine, particularly with our robust Second Amendment perception, I guess, in this country, and we can talk about that. I think there's a misperception of the scope of the Second Amendment, but that kind of solution is terrifying. But the fact that we're having that discussion is really problematic. And I just want to make two points. One is for listeners, if you're feeling bereft in this moment, understandably, but most states do allow mail-in voting, and those laws are changing as we speak. So everyone should get online to your Secretary of State and ask for your absentee ballot now. That's number one. Number two is the studies show, as much as I think voter fraud, first of all, is largely a myth. You're more likely to be, and I'm ad-libbing here, bitten by a shark than to actually have an election changed by voter fraud. But the president himself admitted the concern is that Democrats will win if there are more people that are allowed to exercise their right to vote. But studies show that's actually not the case, that when it comes to mail-in voting, that it actually helps both sides of the aisle. And I don't know what we're so afraid of, to have Americans decide their own elections.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of worst case scenarios, I guess I don't worry about Donald Trump refusing to leave the White House, and coming to that I'm more concerned about him tainting the election and sort of going into the wilderness, throwing stink bombs in his wake, which also has the ability to degrade confidence and faith in democracy. In fact, I'm sure that there's actually part of Donald Trump that wants to play the eternal victim and to go and start his own TV network where, he will be the president in exile. But I can't, even in my darkest times, I don't imagine this is going to be decided by guys with guns. I am not there. But one of the things we've learned is that every time we think, well, it can't get any worse, right? It can't get worse than that. And then in fact, It does.
I agree. I'm not saying that this is going to happen by any means, and people shouldn't be panicking about that. But I don't think anyone thought we'd be where we are right now with, you know, the White House, New York Times reported that they were lying to the American people about the projections of deaths. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dead Americans and not enough body bags. So I don't think any sort of apocalyptic prediction is off the table. And I just tend to think we need to at least, you know, see the possibilities in order to make our way through the forest. And part of that is just naming them.
You know, you mentioned the Second Amendment earlier. I'm a big Second Amendment fan, but this is actually kind of interesting. Even Sean Hannity last night said, hey, maybe we ought to dial back on these armed protests. Yeah. This is not actually helping. Now, I'm guessing that he's saying that because he realizes how that's playing in public opinion. But, you know, this has become a thing now. People showing up at the state houses with AR-15s. Showing up heavily armed, brandishing weapons, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people out there who think that, well, yeah, this is a robust defense, you know, Minuteman defense of the Bill of Rights, but it is creepy, and it seems designed to intimidate. It seems designed to say that if we don't get our way, that this thing might turn violent. I don't know any other way to interpret that.
Yeah, and the president is kind of encouraged. And there's a great book called How Democracies Die by two Harvard professors that came out a couple years ago that traces democracies across the globe kind of falling into something that is nominally a democracy, but it's really more like authoritarianism. And one of the elements of that is sort of prompting violence from the bully pulpit. The locker up, of course, was the original chant. And also this myth, as I mentioned, about the Second Amendment. I mean, the Supreme Court did, in the Heller decision, do a turnaround in terms of Second Amendment jurisprudence and held that it doesn't just apply to militias, but it is an individual right, but it's limited. It's limited to the ability to, under that case, to have handguns in the home for self-defense. And it really comes down to this concept of privacy, that your home is your castle and government can't tell you what you can do to protect your families. That's a far cry from, you know, barging in and intimidating legislators with serious ammunition, and also intimidating the public. That's not what the Second Amendment, at least as it's been construed by the Supreme Court to date, protects. Like every piece of the Constitution, including the First Amendment, it's limited. It's always a balancing act. Public safety does matter in terms of the scope of our constitutional rights. And we're seeing that with back to our mask conversation. They're not unlimited, but by definition, they're not unlimited because we have a republic. We have an ordered society. And I don't think people want anarchy. I really don't. They're not sure what they're signing themselves up for, frankly.
Yeah, this whole issue of open carry has always been somewhat interesting. You know, here in Wisconsin, we have a lot of people who have guns, and it's a very pro-gun culture, I would say. And during the fight over concealed carry, the former state attorney general issued an opinion saying, yeah, you have a constitutional right, however, to open carry without any requirements whatsoever. So you need to do some things to get a permit to conceal carry, but under Wisconsin law right now, the way it's being enforced, if you carry a rifle, you know, down the street, that's completely okay. And so you do have these, and this whole notion of constitutional carry is why folks will show up at these rallies with these guns. But even in Wisconsin, though, I think there was sort of a common sense repulsion against that. You know, what are you doing? What message are you trying to send? Because I remember discussing this, a couple of guys showed up at a farmer's market in order to make a point, you know, carrying AR-15s. And the overwhelming public response was, man, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? I don't want my family and friends to be around. You may be law abiding, but it's creepy. And I think that you're seeing that as well. And maybe that explains why you have this brief moment of sanity from Sean Hannity.
Yeah,
brief moment. I don't want to give him a lot of credit for it.
Right. And this comes back to, you know, this this congressional question, and what should Congress do? I mean, the limits of any constitutional right are tested when government tries to impose some kind of boundary. So the reason that there's an understanding maybe in Wisconsin that open carry is constitutional is because there hasn't been a law banning it that went all the way to the Supreme Court. Now, last week or the week before, the Supreme Court basically dismissed or refused to consider a case involving a limitation in New York City on carrying a weapon to a firing range outside of the city because it was moot. And Justice Alito wrote a dissenting opinion basically arguing that we should have taken this up anyway. But New York backed off. That's how this goes. A state will pass a law. It gets challenged. It either goes to the Supreme Court and the court says it's constitutional or not. But absent any limitations, the sky is the limit. That's essentially how this functions. And to your point, maybe people are someone who says, who's working inside a private supermarket, whose boss says you can't let anyone in without a mask, like you mentioned happened in Michigan. And all they're doing is doing their job so they can go home with their paycheck and feed their families. And private actors get to, no shirt, no service. You know, they get to decide who gets to come in their stores. And this person gets murdered? This is not acceptable.
Do you want to talk about Tara Reid at all?
Yes, I thought you might want to bring that up.
Okay, not everybody wants to talk about these things. I'm getting more and more interested in whether or not this is going to shift people's attitudes towards due process and the credibility. Right before we came on the air, I was actually trying to do a Google search on who believed Julie Swetnick. Remember her? And also a woman named Monroe Leighton. Monroe Leighton was one of the women who had made made an allegation against Brett Kavanaugh that was publicized, and she later admitted that she just made it up. Okay, so just leave her aside. And then you have Julie Swetnick, who was Michael Avenatti's client. Yeah. And I think that was one of the turning points in the entire Kavanaugh case when people realized, okay, this is completely bogus. It doesn't hold up at all. It fell apart very, very quickly. And I think that one of the reasons why, frankly, the Kavanaugh got confirmed was because you had these bogus allegations. But I was trying to determine, how many people out there took Julie Swetnick seriously and whether or not that should be a lesson for how we deal with this. So I'm just throwing these things out.
Yeah, no, this is a really tricky question because there's, of course, a lot of other things at stake, including everything we've talked about so far with respect to the November election and getting government back on track with anyone in the White House other than this quasi madman. The Me Too movement, as a woman with four daughters, I think it is really important to treat sexual assault as serious, and kind of the bimbo mentality is being okay in this country is really something that needs to change. That being said, I mean, from a lawyer's perspective, the flaws in this story, including just that there's the complaint that was allegedly filed with the Senate for sexual harassment or whatever the contents are. She doesn't have a copy of that. She doesn't know what the timing of it is. Just in our regular lives, we know when someone's telling a story that has big holes in it, and the fact that it has to do with alleged sexual harassment or sexual assault of a woman doesn't somehow undermine our ability to bring common sense and logic to a narrative that doesn't hold up.
Yeah, and I think that's important. Is part of the problem was I think that we had gone so far in dismissing the allegations that we did forget there was a reason why you were innocent until proven guilty, and so the presumption of guilt was always a dangerous path out there, and you had things thrown out. I think one of the other interesting things is that we have been using contemporaneous testimony. People will say, well, she told me this at the time, as being really very, very powerful evidence. But over the weekend, you saw this out of Delaware. We had this bizarre story from former Republican Senate candidate Christine O'Donnell that her niece had been sexually harassed by Joe Biden. That story fell apart almost immediately within 24 hours. But the website that published it said they had six people who said, yes, we were told that at the time, but now we know it didn't occur. So a lot of this stuff is a lot fuzzier than I hope people on both sides of the aisle realize that.
Yeah. And of course we also, I mean, in a weird way, we have Me Too that has brought this issue to the forefront. So people are, some are on pins and needles around it and eggshells are, and some people feel really good about the fact that this has become legitimized. But on the other hand, we've got a president who has dozens of women who accused him and he's claiming victim on that. So we've also become desensitized to this, including, you know, Christine Blasey Ford. I think the way she was treated and the way that, that the FBI didn't perform a legitimate background check. I mean, I remember being in law school during the Clarence Thomas hearings, and what was impressed upon me was that this is really a job interview. A due process is a concept that really goes to being put in jail. Largely, you know, and back in the Magna Carta, government has to give you process before they take your liberty away. And, you know, Joe Biden's running for an important office. So so he said himself, this is not something that should just be trivialized or ignored. But that being said, that there are, the other person on the ballot, potentially Donald Trump, isn't exactly in a position to be kicking Joe Biden or his supporters off of the ballot for this one allegation. It's just I don't know. It's hard to wrap my mind around it. I think this is one of those very, very gray areas where we have to be careful to be one note and ideological on it. We just do.
Well, I agree with that. And also, I mean, this is, we have a piece by Amanda Carpenter up in the Bulwark today, basically saying to the Trump world, I mean, really, you guys believe, if you support Donald Trump, maybe you should sit this one out. So there's an element of this that, and I apparently poked a hive of some right-wing trolls who are like, really love this story of Tara Reid. I'm fascinated by that, her thing about Vladimir Putin. And whether or not, you know what I'm talking about? She wrote an essay, which has now been deleted. Apparently, she wanted to memory hole it. And she writes things like President Putin's obvious reverence for women, children, and animals, and his ability with sports is intoxicating to American women. President Putin has an alluring combination of strength with gentleness. His sensuous image projects his love for life, the embodiment of grace while facing adversity. It is evident that he loves his country, his people, and his job. Through my lens, President Putin brought a chaotic and failed nation to become a vibrant, creative, economic force within a decade. Just admit that his sheer calculated vision and willful energy brought Russia back.
Yeah.
So that's
so weird.
Okay. So, is that weird? It is. And so I tweeted out, why did she delete this? That's all I said. Now, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, you know, who is this woman and what's going on here? But again, it was, why did she delete it? And I get, you're trying to silence the woman. No, she's the one that deleted it. I'm asking, why did she delete it? And we got these right wing trolls saying, are you saying that somehow this disqualifies her allegation? No, but the issue of credibility seems relevant, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I saw that. Going back to Christine Blasey Ford, I mean, just from a lawyer's perspective, she was a very, very persuasive witness. I mean, she was credible. She was sincere and honest, and it was difficult on cross-examination to challenge her credibility. Now, imagine this person, Ms. Reid, on the stand with this piece that you mentioned, and a lawyer cross-examining her, when we all know this is not difficult, that Vladimir Putin is no friend to America, and he's certainly not the humanitarian that it seems to be portrayed in this, in the excerpts that you read. So you know, people can make decisions on someone's credibility. That we do this all the time in our lives. This is how
credibility, motivation, exactly.
Our system is totally, it hinges on this. And again, Joe Biden's not going to jail. Brett Kavanaugh was, his liberty wasn't at stake. Clarence Thomas's liberty wasn't at stake. So we can loosen some of these rules of evidence, but we don't need to leave our logic at the door. And I think that was a legitimate question that you raised, Charlie. Why would she remove that if she's not willing to stand behind it? Then I think it's fair game to ask why.
Well, I mean, it does seem important to mention, along with the changing stories and the fact that this the complaint may not have alleged this particular conduct. It's also legitimate to ask, what is your credibility? What is your judgment? What are your motivations? The fact that she's a big Bernie bro and she was pushing Bernie and, you know, campaigning for Bernie, and she's out there and she didn't come up with this particular version of the story publicly until the campaign is over. But here's the thing. You know what the Breitbart Federalist crowd would have done. If Christine Blasey Ford had ever written gushing love notes to blood-soaked dictators, you know what would have happened. They would have completely lost their shit.
Oh, yeah.
And so watching them now go, don't even bring this up. This has nothing to do with anything. Are you kidding me? Now, again, it's not dispositive. It doesn't mean that this didn't happen. It doesn't mean it's just... It is a data point, and it's a fascinating data point.
Well, hypocrisy is ubiquitous right now. But I mean, you know, a couple of points on that. I wonder if this is going to change anyone's vote anyway. And Trump supporters are going to vote for Trump, and I don't think people that want to see someone else in office are going to not show up by virtue of this one allegation relating to Joe Biden. So I don't know how much it's going to really impact. And secondly, I kind of wish the media, ourselves maybe included, would move off the story,
right?
because the house is burning down around us. I mean, literally people are dying. We don't have a plan in place for addressing it. The federal government has pretty much done virtually nothing. Closed the borders to China, sort of, because lots of people got in, and testing is up, but not where it needs to be. If you look at the number of infections, we're over a million something, and the next closest country, of course, the population's lower, is Spain at 200,000. I mean, we are just losing across the board. We don't have ubiquitous testing. We don't have contract tracing in place. We don't even have, I mean, Cuomo came out with a multi-point logical plan for getting back the economy open and getting back to work. And I just wish these people that are so upset about having to stay home would instead shift their demands for a government response that allows them to go back to work.
You would think.
Hand sanitizer for everybody, masks for everybody, testing for everybody, contact tracing. I mean, it can be done. It's just not being done. And we're getting the worst of both worlds right now. And I just think this Tara Reid thing is just unfortunate, an unfortunate digression.
It is a digression. And it's one of those things that if you didn't like Joe Biden, this will be another data point. But if you do like Joe Biden, it's not going to probably change your mind. And so I think we sometimes overestimate how much a single thing affects someone's vote. Usually, and particularly in this race, I've been reading a lot of polls. I'm sure you've been looking at the polls. Mm-hmm. The overwhelming theme that runs through a few, just aggregate, not just the polls now, but over the last year, is how stable this race is, which just tells me that the vast, vast majority of Americans have made up their minds and made it up very, very strongly. So things like this are sort of straws in the wind. And as we know, it's the beginning of May. By October, this is almost everything else we talk about, except for the pandemic, is going to seem like ancient history. But I don't think the pandemic will seem like ancient history. Kim Whaley, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it. Really enjoy when you come on.
Same here. Thank you for having me, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.